here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Get one. It's the new year. We're going to do what we can. Happy New Year to you. I hope you had a good New Year. Mark Riley, still on vacation in England. We'll be back on Wednesday. Man, he must have had a good time. What's it been, like a year since he's been gone?
Sorry about it.
With me today, you know that voice. It's the voice of Air America News. Wayne Gilman is in the
Good morning, Mr. Marin. Good morning. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
It's an honor and a pleasure
and
to have you.
So England is part of New Jersey.
I guess so. What are you talking about? Is he in New Jersey?
Oh, please.
Come on.
You know, I don't know Riley to spend a dime. I've known Riley for 30 years. You know, if he's gone to England, his wife spent the money.
Well, that's what he said. His wife did the whole thing.
Exactly.
Because you also know that Riley won't fly anywhere if he doesn't have to, apparently.
That's true.
He doesn't like the flying thing.
Actually, I've come to that conclusion myself after 9/11. You know?
Yeah, are you nervous about flying?
Yeah, you know, there was a time I used to fly all the time. In fact, the last flight I took, I went to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It was about 4 years ago. More than 4 years ago now.
Yeah.
The Democratic National Convention. Flew out, drove back. Something I always wanted to do.
Oh, was that it? You didn't freak out when you got there? You're like, I didn't get that guy another plane.
Well, you know, LA has that impact on you.
Oh,
But apart from that, you know, you just get, there was a time, I guess, we had the flight, I can't think of the, it was a TWA flight that fell over Cinema Riches on the island there a couple of years back.
Yeah.
And then right after that, you had a progression of series of commercial American flights that were just dropping from the sky.
Right.
And once you realize that you're nothing more but an insurance right off of these companies, you know, you start thinking about your life differently when you enter a plane.
Oh, man, I got
to
call my wife.
I
She's leaving this
that,
morning.
You know?
I'm going to have to call my wife. Don't do it. Stay here.
Yeah, well, you can always drive out and pick her up. And
I love driving. I love driving across country. The last time I did it was in a U-Haul. So let me ask you some questions, Wayne Gelman, because I don't get the privilege of hanging out and talking to you like Dan Pashman, Sonny Lewis, and Linda Pashman in New Jersey does every morning.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit, because I know there's a lot of people out there. There's a small cult of Gelman out there in the Air America world.
Yeah, my family.
Yeah, the family. No. There are actually people that write in, like, what's up with Wayne Gilman? Where did he come from? So how long have you been here?
I've been here for a long, I mean, as far as New York area is concerned.
Well, on the air, what's your...
Well, all right, I've been in the business about 33 years, it's hard to believe. You know, I started out working for one of our competitors down the street, which was under the leadership of Westinghouse at the time.
Okay.
An all-news station, WINS, for those of you in New York.
I remember INS. It's still here.
Yeah, still here, exactly.
I remember.
Under new leadership now, we started out there. As a writer, from there, I joined Inner City Broadcasting in the early 1970s. And it has been an incredible ride.
So you knew the disco, Riley.
Oh, please. You know, I mean, Mark is very modest about it, and I know we've talked about this off air, but Mark was one of the original weekend disco jocks in the country.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a phenomenon that is now etched in history. Mark started this back, I guess, in 1971, 72.
What do you mean the phenomenon? The disco jock, like he was a what you would call a, like a mix master?
Yeah, he would mix music, and usually what would happen is that on FM radio back in the early 70s, Saturday nights, Friday nights particularly, they would have a jock on the air between midnight and 6 a.m.
Okay.
Just spinning music.
Yeah.
And Mark started that trend.
So he was that guy.
He was the first person I know in this area.
Like midnight party with
exactly
Mark Riley?
That sort of thing. You know? And, I mean, there's so many stories I could share about Mark.
Uh-huh.
You know, Mark is trying to change his life now and present himself as, you know. But, I mean, there's stories about Mark that go back. I mean, precious stories.
Well,
the time he tried to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge.
No, wait a minute.
You know, and,
for real?
Yeah, there was a period of time that Mark was, you know, faced with a set of, you know, I better not go in. You know, maybe his family might be listening.
That's a hell of a tear.
Yeah. You know, I'll let him talk about it.
All right, you're right. We could do the lighter-hearted story.
Right.
So now, how was your New Year's, Wayne?
It was good.
You know,
traditionally, I'm not one to go out on New Year's Eve. About 20-some-odd years ago, I was married at the time.
Yeah.
There was a local dance emporium here in New York. In fact, one of the former owners is still a friend of mine.
A dance emporium?
A disco, if you will. Back then, all right? And the deal is that it was on 6th Avenue, and I think somewhere along the 30s.
Yeah.
And we spent a ton of money getting into this club.
Yeah.
accompanied by friends and things like
sure.
that.
Sure, big party.
Big party.
Yeah.
About 250 people were in this club.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, after midnight,
yeah.
when, at the height of the celebration,
oh, no.
the front door slammed shut.
Yeah.
Two guys walk in with sawed-off shotguns.
Oh, man.
They demand that everyone strip down to their the men particularly strip down to their underwear.
Yeah.
The women naked.
Was this just part of the party?
No, no, it wasn't part of the party. You know, we were all cleaned out that night.
Oh,
you know,
man.
Particularly the women. And I vowed since then, you know, and actually it was just this past weekend that I made an exception. I broke my rule after
yeah.
some 20 years, and I went to a house party.
And
ironically, the house party that I attended was given by some people in the New York City Police Department.
I thought you were going to say, ironically, I'm at the house party. 10 after midnight, the door's shut. Two guys with shotguns walked in,
right.
and they
take
the clothes off.
Yeah, yeah. But it was, I thought it was an embarrassing experience. It
yeah.
made all the local papers.
Well, it's a memorable New Year's.
Uh-huh. How was yours?
Well, you know, I don't, I'm the same way. I don't like going places.
Yeah.
I don't really like crowds that much. I don't like the mob scene. So I'd rather just celebrate with my wife. So we ended up doing comedy because she wanted to do some comedy. So we went to Boston Comedy Club. Usually, if you book a gig in advance
mm-hmm.
On New Year's, it's a big money night.
Right.
And I just
right.
don't like to work on New
yeah.
Year's because it's a pain in the ass. You know, you got people, you know, drunk people babysitting,
mm-hmm.
and it's like it's you know, Happy New Year. That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, come on. You know, let's just get on with the day, and we'll, you know, I don't know. I think it's BS is what I'm saying. So what happened was we went out and did comedy, and there were miserable little crowds. And the first show, some woman just kept going, woo! Yeah! And everything I'd say, I'd like say, so I was on the train. The train! Ow! And I'm like, oh, my God.
That bad.
Oh, it was awful. You know, and then that was bad. And then the second show, it just got worse,
mm-hmm.
and I just hated myself for doing it, and I was mad, and I went into the next
but
day.
But did you get
mad.
Paid?
I got paid okay.
Okay, but that's
what I'm saying. If I would have done the real thing and
mm-hmm.
booked the gig a few months in advance for the big dough,
oh,
I would have
okay.
got a big. This is something I picked up in the last couple of weeks. Well, sure, I'll do it. What the hell?
Right.
You know, it was such a mistake.
Mm.
It made me rethink everything. It made me make some new resolutions about comedy. I'll tell you that. Maybe I'll get into those later. But I want to talk about Shirley Chisholm has passed away. And we're
yeah.
going to talk, and you knew her, you interviewed
mm-hmm.
her. Let's talk a little bit about that when we come back. Wayne
okay.
Gilman is with me. It's 13 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. I'm Mark Maron. You're listening to Morning Sedition. It's the new year. I hope it's going as well as possible. It's only been 2 days. I hope it isn't screwed up yet. I'm sitting here with Wayne Gilman, who was sitting in for Mark Riley, who was sitting in England, maybe watching a soccer game, perhaps sleeping. I don't know.
England, New Jersey.
No. I wonder if he... No, I think he's really there.
Really?
I think yeah.
How come he gets all this time off?
I don't know how that worked out.
Yeah,
really. I think that he had vacation time stacked up, and he just took him back to back. The whole show was off,
uh-huh.
you know, last week. And
yeah.
I guess, you know, I don't know. It just worked out for him. I'm taking a month off.
Oh, really?
No. So, you know, honestly, you know, I was, when Shirley Chisholm ran for president in 72, I was 9 years old. I remember her on the cover of Ms. Magazine. I was a very young man at the time. I don't have a lot of recollection
yeah.
of, you know, who she was. And I do remember it was a big deal. And I would like you to give me a little history.
You know, I tell you, it's ironic that I'm called in to do the show today and this would suddenly happen because Shirley Chisholm, in my estimation, had a pivotal role in my being in broadcasting,
really?
to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
She was one of the first assignments I had covering her. I actually was at the funeral of the late, great Congressman Adam Clayton Powell, Jr.,
mm-hmm.
up in the Villas of Harlem, the Abyssinian Baptist Church, the historic facility up there. And Chisholm was among those attending the funeral.
What year was it?
We're talking 1971, 72.
Okay.
Trying to jog my memory now. and the thing is I wish I could say I was nine, but I wasn't there. And the thing is that a very articulate individual, a visionary of her time, first black woman congressman, as we mentioned, you know, but someone who basically was way ahead of her time.
Yeah.
She was like someone who basically was responsible for shaping the mindsets of young black politicians in the early 1970s. What we have today,
yes,
basically Shirley Chisholm gave birth to.
Which is, what in specific?
Well, I mean, well, for instance, even running for the presidency.
Sure.
All right, she was the first black of that particular generation, before the Reverend Jesse Jackson, before the Reverend Al Sharpton, to actually seriously consider a run. And, of course, you know, at that time, at the tail end of the Civil Rights Movement, her, you know, entering such a contest, I mean, right now, it's kind of far-fetched. The closest thing that we've had to someone assuming the presidency would be Colin Powell.
Yeah.
You know, until he timed himself out of the Bush White House. But, I mean, and I shouldn't even say
professional
that. Well, we'll get into that later on, all right, but that's my opinion. But, I mean, the bottom line is that I feel that Shirley Chisholm, her, you know, she's one of the unsung heroes of her time.
And she started in the Congress in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, right.
Do you remember when she was elected to Congress?
I believe it was 1968.
Right.
And the district that she was in is the largest is still the largest black constituency in the city of New York, in the state of New York, as a matter of fact, Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. And really a credit to her ancestry. She has a similar background to mine. I believe she spent the first few years of her life in the Caribbean before coming to this country.
Mm.
And certainly grew up in the New York area and became a formidable figure in politics.
And I guess her slogan was unbought and unbossed.
Yeah, I saw that early and I had forgotten about that, but she was very much about that and left Congress in frustration because she couldn't get many of the things that she wanted accomplished.
Uh-huh.
You know, the country just was not ready for Shirley Chisholm at the time.
Yeah, I saw a movie over the weekend, mm-hmm. The assassination of Richard Nixon, about this guy Samuel Bick. It was based on him. He was a sort of a down-and-out kind of losery kind of nebbishy guy who apparently, you know, set out to assassinate the president,
mm-hmm.
and everything got bungled up, and I think he ended up killing some people trying to hijack the plane. He got shot himself. But there was just that period of time, you know, they had a lot of TV pieces of Nixon on television talking to the people. And because I was not cognizant at that time, you know, I was so young that, you know, a lot of the stuff that happens politically in the last 15 or 20, or, you know, 15 years, 10 years, to me, it's all very surprising. You know, it's all like, you know, wow, this is like, this guy's the worst it could ever have been, you know, like George Bush is the worst. And he arguably is the worst, but you forget that, you know, politicians have been creepy, evil bastards all along.
Exactly.
So I can only imagine that when a woman like Shirley Chisholm comes along, the culture just must have been like, whoa!
I know, exactly.
This must have been incredible.
No one expected that. I mean, again, you know, you consider someone who was black, someone from a predominantly minority area in the city of New York. New York was progressive then as it is now.
Sure.
You know, the rest of the country wasn't ready for stuff. And the thing about Shirley Chisholm, you know, we talked today about Al Sharpton being the master of the 30-second soundbite.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she came from a completely different perspective, but just as quick-witted, just as sharp, to respond to the press, and didn't take any prisoners with her.
When you talked to her, what did you guys talk about?
Well, we talked about the passing of Adam Powell at the time. We talked about New York City politics.
Was she planning on running for president when you talked to her?
There was already talk in the air about her doing that, but no one ever thought that she would even, you know, try to rise to such a lofty height. And when she did, she sort of reshaped the landscape for women getting into politics.
Absolutely.
You know, by her just entering the contest. You know, after her, Barbara Jordan out of Texas, just as an articulate representative, was also very much a big person in the political scene, but Shirley Chisholm basically was the harbinger for all that has come since then.
Right. She was 82 years old when she passed away, which isn't young. She had a good life, and it was great talking to you about her.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move into Iraq a little bit, because we've got a guest coming up. We've got Jimmy Massey's going to be back with us, specifically to address some of the tactics of recruiting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they have said they're not going to do a draft. There is a backdoor draft in the process, and it doesn't look like things are getting any better in Iraq, does it?
No, it certainly doesn't. I mean, the thing is, each day, you know, we read reports of more suicide bombings. I think the death toll, the American death toll, is now well past 1,300.
Yes.
And the fact that really, what really gets to me is that the recruitment in this country is also increasing.
Right.
You know, why I find that unfathomable, that there's so many young people looking to sign up for the armed forces, considering what's going on in Iraq.
Yeah,
when I was, you know, not to cut you, but some 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
or even more than that now, you know, during the Vietnam era, there was a mandatory draft, of course. And when there was a war going on, you know, you best kept your grades up if you were in school, just to avoid getting into the war.
Did anything you could to stay out of the war.
Exactly. Yeah. I remember once as a kid growing up in Brooklyn, partying with friends of mine, upperclassmen, in Coney Island, you know, the large amusement park in Brooklyn.
Sure.
And the next day, these guys were in Saigon. Some of them never even made it through the week.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And to think in this generation that there's this attraction, I'm curious to find out from Massey, what is the attraction? Is it money? I mean, we're in a poor economy. And I have a personal axe. I don't want to break the confidence of a family member.
Okay.
It's something I've talked about for some time. But it bothers me what they do to recruit minorities in this armed forces community.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, what are you, what are some of the
things
specifically?
They pick people who are vulnerable,
mm-hmm.
people who are, at least in my estimation.
Almost like a religious group.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And the thing is, I think that there's this disingenuous behavior on their part where they'll stretch a truth to make it look like, you know, you'll be better off than trying to work in a private industry.
I imagine they push off so they sort of like, when you get out, all the benefits you're going to get.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
The military pension.
You know, the government will take care of you for the rest of your life.
You'll be trained in a skill.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I think the one thing that really gets to me, and I want to ask him about this, is the fact that at least in this particular instance, and again, I don't want to break her confidence, but it bothers me that someone was lied to.
Right.
That there will never be a war again after Gulf One.
Right.
You know, another war again. There would never, ever be a war.
Yeah, and then they sort of changed it to a war like this war, and now there's clearly a big war going on, and yet people are still being recruited.
But the war is over. This ended in 2003, forget.
Right.
You know, in March, it was one
sure.
March.
Sure,
know?
Yeah, tell that to the 33 guys that were killed today, or yesterday.
It's garbage.
Yeah, of course it's garbage. And what you're saying is true in that, you know, what is it that draws them to it? Because they know the score. Many people aren't even, you know, are obviously against this war. Many soldiers are against this war, yet they're still getting involved with the military, either for the adventure, for the money, for, you know, for the experience.
I think it's money. I mean, if I were, you know, caught between a rock and a hard place, and given the economy the way it is, as, you know, I said this, I said this on the air on our sister station a while back, but there are people who are walking the streets with law degrees with a Walmart job opportunity only in front of them.
That's true. There's no guarantee in anything anymore.
Exactly.
We'll talk to Jimmy Massey about it when we come back. We've also got the Palm Pilot coming up, hopefully, if Ramon shows up, and much more. I'm here with Wayne Gelman. It's 28 past the hour on Air America Radio.
On Air America Radio.
I am Mark Maron. I am here with Wayne Gelman, who is in for Mark Riley, who is in England. We screwed up. Shirley Chisholm was 80 years old when she passed away yesterday, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, Raymond has brought me the Palm Pilot. It's nice to see him again. He was wearing some sort of something people in Florida would wear. Anyways, this is Colin Powell's Palm Pilot for today, 8 a.m. Prepare to travel to South Asia to inspect tsunami damage. Note, why is it never, hey, Colin, why don't you go over to Monaco and check out the situation there? 9 a.m., have limo pick up Jeb Bush. Boy, buy stuff to keep him occupied on long plane trip. Game Boy, crayons, Vicodin, latest issues of Maxim, stuff, FHM. 11 a.m., note, only 2 weeks left at this job. Now I can say things to Jeb like, yeah, I dropped the ball at Times Square 3 nights ago, and your brother's been dropping the ball for the past 4 years. Go ahead, squeal on me. Go ahead. 8 p.m., arrive in Thailand. Note to Jeb, even though it's spelled P-H-U-K-E-T, it's pronounced Phuket. 10 p.m. Keep Jeb from saying things to the locals like, well, this is bad, but you should see what the hurricanes did to some of our golf courses down around Boca. 11:30 p.m. Promise officials more aid money. Note, if they don't like $350 million, make it $750 million or a billion, whatever. I'm out of here in 2 weeks, and you can keep Jeb, too. There you go. There's Jimmy is on the phone. He's been on our show a few times. He's joining us from North Carolina. He's a former staff sergeant in the Marines. He also worked as a recruiter from 1999 to 2001. Good morning, Jimmy Massey. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for being on again. So now, my co-host and I, Wayne Gelman, were talking about recruiting and some of the tactics that they're used in recruitment. Where did you primarily do the recruiting when you were working?
I was located in western North Carolina and currently where I live.
Uh-huh.
I covered basically the entire finger of western North Carolina.
Now, what did they tell you to do? I mean, what is protocol? Who did they tell you to approach, and what kind of directives were you provided as far as, you know, who you approach and what you say to them?
Well, there's a system. It's called systematic recruiting, and in the process of doing the systematic recruiting, there is no really guideline of who you approach or whatnot, but I can tell you that mainly what we were looking for, or what I was looking for in a new applicant, was working class, didn't have the money to go to college. So that was primarily the target that I was looking for in a new recruit.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Massey, good morning. Wayne Gilman here. I'm pinch hitting for Mark Riley, the morning's edition here. I was just curious, was one of the prerequisites for what you were doing included lying, if you don't mind?
Hey, you know, I gotta love you, being honest.
Well, I'm being, you know, let's keep it real now. I want to elevate the conversation.
Sure. I'll tell you this. I said, I did, I begged, borrowed, cheated, lied, stole, whatever, to find a new recruit or potential applicant.
To what extent? Like, what type of lies would you tell people who are on? I imagine it's a sales pitch you're talking about primarily.
Right, right. And then again, you have to look at what is the definition of a lie. I mean, if we go all the way back to the Clinton administration, he didn't understand what the definition between oral sex or whatnot.
Well, understood. So, but, I mean, but you know, we understand that it's a sales pitch. But what are you promising people? I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
What I'm promising people is, or when I was a recruiter, was a way of life, that they were going to, get rid of the economic conscript within the working class, and then, you know, bring them into this military mindset where they're going to get taken care of. They're not going to have to worry about medical. They're not going to have to worry about finding a college education or affording a college education.
And also you would tell them they wouldn't have to worry about war on some level, yeah?
Right, just depending on their occupation and what they were going into in the Marines.
But tell me this, were you actually trained to do this? Were you given instructions to lie?
Well, here's the thing. No Marine recruiter has ever been told, you must lie. But however, he is told, or she's told, that they must find 3 bodies a month. And if they don't find that 3 bodies a month, then their career up to that point, generally you're looking at somebody that's been in the military for about 8 years before they become a recruiter, so that their career might be jeopardized if they don't produce those 3 bodies a month. So there's a lot of pressure on the recruiter to produce. So he or she looks for guidance in the senior recruiters, and the senior recruiters explain to them that sometimes the rules have to be bent, and in order for you to grease up the porthole and put that, you know, pass that person through.
You know, not to cut you off, what really, bothers me about this is that once you've signed up, you can't think twice. I mean, if someone who's being recruited is in a very vulnerable position in their life, and then suddenly, like 6 months later, things get better, say that if they're not working currently when they find you, and 6 months after they get the dream job of a lifetime, they can't change their circumstances with the armed forces, can they?
Well, that's correct. They cannot change their military occupational specialty once they go to boot camp.
Yeah, but it's all right for you to lie to them, though, huh?
Now, once they graduate from boot camp and they go on to their occupation school, that's it. They're locked into that program that they signed up for.
Okay, let's talk.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm forgive me, that pisses me off.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah.
You know, and it's and what bothers me even more so is that a disproportionate share of minorities get caught up in that crap.
Yeah, let's talk about that. The demographics that you, I guess we could say, prey upon on that level is it's fairly specific because there is more minority people in the armed forces and more people below the poverty line as well in the armed forces. I have to assume that there is a predatory nature to the job.
Oh, sure. I mean, you're... A Marine recruiter is the biggest predator in the world. Like I said, I didn't care what I had to do to find that contract. And generally, when you're talking about economic classes, I recruited working class kids that came from broken homes, single parent, that were vulnerable.
Is your working class, when you say working class, does your class system include a lower class?
Oh, sure.
I mean,
I'm talking about where parents, you know, work at Hardee's part-time and then work at Walmart part-time and have three kids.
Okay. So you're probably talking about working class below the poverty line in a lot of ways.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. Now, when you dealt with these kids, a lot of these kids, I assume, probably didn't have a very strong family structure at home, as you said, and, you know, either they were destined for trouble. How much of that was part of the pitch? Like, you know, if you stay on the track you're on, you're probably going to end up in jail.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's you know, getting on the sympathy level really helps to promote recruits.
And also playing a paternal role a little bit, doing the sort of like, you know, you'll get the discipline you need, you'll get the leadership qualities and that kind of stuff.
Right, we call that getting the intangible traits in life, you know, things like honor, courage, self-discipline, self-respect, those things.
So you make a kid who probably hates himself, he's got no real self-esteem, he's probably angry at the world, and you make it seem like, you know, if he just does what, if he signs on the dotted line, he's going to have dignity and integrity and honor and everything else.
Right, right. Then he can go kill innocent civilians.
One thing I wanted to ask you is the situation with schools in terms of the recruitment drive. Are you better off in certain institutions being devoid of that activity as opposed to others?
Are you talking about like the ROTC program?
Yeah.
Yeah, the ROTC programs, which are, you know, the schools actually have to, you know, have that, well, the personnel that runs these are generally retired personnel.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the kids that are, you know, they spend the 4 years in the ROTC definitely go on to a military career. And we are, that's prime pickings within the recruiting world.
And largely, what kind of schools are those that basically feature those programs then? They're not Ivy League colleges.
No, certainly not. These are just regular high schools within, you know, the heart of America, and primarily the South. The South is the number one recruiting region in the United States, and the number one recruiting state is Texas.
Oh, okay.
So now, hey Jimmy, you feel guilty about anything? You want to confess anything? In terms of, did you walk away from this job with any particular story in your head that you felt bad about?
Yeah, there was a young man, his name's Tim Queen.
Mm-hmm.
He was out in a little town called Murphy, North Carolina. And he had a neurological disorder. We knew that. We went ahead and signed him up anyways and told him to lie about his medical. I didn't even think the young man was going to be able to make it through the Mets because of his physical condition. He did make it through Mets, and we shipped him off to boot camp. The drill instructors didn't, as soon as he stepped off the bus, noticed him and pulled him off to the side, and he never even made it that far, any further in the Marine Corps. They discharged him out. They said that he was a fraudulent enlistment. He came back home. The Congressman Charles Taylor office conducted an investigation on it and ruled that this young man lied about his medical condition. But I felt bad about it because we're the ones that told him to lie about it.
That's sick.
All right. Well, you put that out into the world. Thanks for sharing that. Thanks for being with us, Jimmy Massey. You still there, Jim? Oh, he's gone. Hey, Jimmy? Are you still there? So what are you doing now? You doing something good with your life?
I tell you what, I've become 80% disabled through the VA system, and I spend every waking moment that I can trying to reach the masses with all of these horrible things that are going on within the military, and hopefully make a positive change so that other young men and women don't do what I had to do.
All right, well, thanks for sharing with us this morning,
Jimmy.
We
applaud you for that.
Okay, you take care. That was Jimmy Massey from Waynesville, North Carolina. That was a heavy story. Hey, I just want to solicit one call. 866-303-2270. If you've had an experience with a recruiter that you didn't end up joining because you were onto the recruiter's BS, you know, share that with us. But that's the only call I'll take. Other than that, we're going to talk about some detention stories coming out of Iraq about the future of detaining potential terrorists. After this, I'm with Wayne Gelman. It's 47 past the hour here on Air America Radio.
Call 866-303-2270. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition. My guest host today, Wayne Gelman, Air America's own. How you feeling there, Wayne?
Just fine.
All right. Riley, still in England. We just talked to Jimmy Massey, who was once a Marine recruiter with some pretty disturbing stuff, and I have a phone call on the line from New Jersey, a guy who was recruited, I believe, and has something to say about that. Steve, how are you?
Hey there. How's it going, Mark?
Pretty good, man. So what's your story with the recruiter? How old were you?
This was right out of high school. Actually, when I was in high school, they had something called the Delayed Entry Program.
How long ago?
20 years ago.
Wow, okay.
And they'll hit you when you're actually in high school, and you can sign up. You're committed in your senior year of high school.
Right.
So, you know, whatever, after you graduate, you're in.
No matter what happens, you sign. They get you before you can even make an adult decision for yourself.
Right.
Okay.
So they told me that my main interest in life was broadcasting. I wanted to be on the radio.
Okay.
And they signed me up as a radioman, which has absolutely nothing to do with broadcasting. It's actually radio communications.
Right.
So I spent 18 hours a day on a teletype writer, and for the to learn how to do this, the testing that I took, you had to type something like 500 words, or it was either words or characters, in 5 minutes with less than 5 mistakes.
Wow.
If those mistakes were in certain areas, you could end up in the brig.
Yeah.
And, you know, this stuff was way beyond anything that I imagined my life being about.
How long were you in for?
I was supposed to be in for 4 years, and I finally just hit bottom and got out a year early.
Right. And did you ever get on radio?
Right now.
Good. Welcome to the world of broadcasting.
My dream has come true. Thank you.
And let alone Air America, as a matter of fact. Steve, you know, if you don't mind, I wanted to find out, what really was your incentive when you signed up for this in the first place?
It was funny listening to the recruiter. I grew up in foster homes. And basically, after high school, I was going to be on a bench in a park if I didn't find something.
Mm.
And my high school counselors had never told me anything about community college. I just figured college was for, you know, rich people. I knew nothing about it. So this was pretty much my only option as far as I know.
Did the high school counselors encourage it?
Actually, she had no idea. She was like 80 years old or something.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling, Steve. Hope you have a good day.
Appreciate it.
You take care. So that's been going on a long time.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this as quickly as we can and maybe get into it later. Apparently, the Pentagon and the CIA have asked the White House to decide on a more permanent approach for potential lifetime detentions for terrorist suspects. Now, these are guys that aren't necessarily accused of anything.
Exactly.
And there's no evidence against them, but it's whether the CIA deems them a threat enough to hold them forever.
Another one of those bright Republican ideas. I don't know who inspired this, but I think what I find so disconcerting about it is what you just mentioned, that some of these people have not been formally charged. You know, we've already faced, this government is already facing, and we're paying in our taxes,
right,
a whole host of lawsuits for trumped-up charges that were brought against detainees, you know, prior to the Iraq war and invasion. You know, so here we go again.
Well, Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana said, quote, it's a bad idea, so we ought to get over it, and we ought to have a very careful constitutional look at this, end quote, which is absolutely true. This is apparently, I didn't realize this, Wayne, but the CIA has held a lot of prisoners, and nobody knows what they're doing with them, and some people don't even know why they're holding them. And they wanted to have their own prison made, and the Pentagon said that's not going to happen. And the new prison they're thinking about designing is something that they're calling Camp 6, which would allow inmates more comfort and freedom than they have now, and would be designed for prisoners the government believes have no more intelligence to share. The official said it would be modeled on a U.S. prison and would allow socializing among inmates who will never get out. You know, and it's just like, it seems very vague to me. But apparently this type of, you know, the CIA detention facilities that they have used have been as sort of isolated as a... they have islands where they put people on. They have barges. Some of the big movers in the Al-Qaeda network were put on a ship, just, you know, sitting out there.
Unbelievable.
But apparently what they use is they want to use this other idea, which is called, I believe it's called renditioning, which is where they will have an agreement with another country. And they'll hold this threat over the suspect's head to put them in the country where they will be held captive by a country that has nothing against torture. So they use it as a threat. Apparently it was put into play originally with the drug cartels. But we'll get to more of that when we come back. Right now, of course, the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Let's see what we got today. One, resolution for 2005 to avoid Bush burnout, divide frustration, anger, and resentment equally among Bush cabinet members over the next 4 years. That's helpful. Two, protest the destruction of the Amazon rainforest by having Cristo wrap it in an orange pleather. 3. Work with designers to finally make hemp clothing fashionable enough for people who aren't stoned to actually wear in public. 4. Don't just diet. Hunger strike. 5. Today's phrase, slip it into any conversation. Oh, sure. The quake, the tsunami were an accident. Right, man. I guess the secret Pentagon weather control project had nothing to do with it. Just stay asleep, sheeple. You're not ready for the truth, buddy. All right, so we're coming back with Wayne Gelman. We've got, who do we got coming up? We've got Peter Ross, who's going to talk to us about the pharmaceutical industry. And later in the show, Jeff Jarvis, our media critic. So stay with us. Air America Radio, 58 times. Mark Maron here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Please get one. It's the new year. We've got 3 or 4 long ones with this guy, and we're just going to have to slowly chip away at everything we can that this president stands for, doesn't stand for. The worst. Wayne Gelman is with me in the studio, the one and only Wayne Gelman.
Oh, geez, thank you.
Yes, sitting in for Mark Riley.
I might add that it's truly an honor and a pleasure to work with you.
Oh, that's very nice. I'm here to learn. That's all I can do, Wayne Gelman.
Learn.
You are the man.
Really? No, Mark Riley is the man. Riley does this every day.
Then I'll call you the professor.
Oh,
if he's the man, you're the professor.
Right.
That's I've just given out. I'm doling out the nicknames here on Morning Sedition. Chris, I'm supposed to call my wife right now and make sure she's up. Can we do that?
Yeah, sure.
I hate to do that on the air, but this is my job.
At home?
Yes. Call her at my house. She's going back to Los Angeles. This could be a sad conversation. Depending on what point of being awake she is. I put your finger on the dump button, too, just in case she...
Is she inclined?
I'm up.
You're also on the air. Good morning, baby.
Morning.
Say hi to Wayne Gelman.
Hi, Wayne.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I guess all right.
So you are awake. You're all good.
Yeah.
Did you feed those kitties?
No, but they act like they want to be fed.
All right, well, maybe you should go ahead and do that, or I don't know. It's up to you. Okay, good. That worked out great. Listen, hey, Wolf, have a good trip back. I love you, all right?
I love you, too.
And I'll call you off the air. What time's the car picking you up?
7:45.
Okay, so you're no cigarettes, right? We're going to stick with this. I'm going to help you all I can.
Day three.
Beautiful. All right, so the car's coming at 7:45?
Yeah.
All right, I'll call you before that, or I'll call you before you get on the plane.
Beautiful.
I love you.
Have a fantastic day.
All right, you too. Bye.
All right.
Oh,
Wolf?
Yeah,
what's that about?
That's your last name.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You thought it was loaded, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's got to be a good story. He's calling her Wolf.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I thought maybe her last name would be Marin or something.
Oh, that's true. That's true. That, you know.
Gee, what a concept.
She comes from the generation of people.
Right.
That, I mean, some people, my first wife did not. Well, she actually added my name to the end of her last name. But Mishna does not want the name. She wants Wolf, and that's why I call. It's so funny because I'm in that situation where I'm actually in stores walking around going, Wolf! Wolf! Like if I lose her in a shopping center or something. And like it's so retarded. Yeah. I mean, ridiculous. Because people are like, there's the boy that cried Wolf. I'm like, Wolf!
And you're not offended by the fact that she doesn't want to bear your last name.
Bear, though. You have a very noble way of speaking, Wayne. I hadn't thought about it as bearing my last name, but now that you...
It's my West Indian upbringing.
Is it? Is that where it is?
Yeah. All right.
I don't think about it. I mean, there are moments where you do it. There's a pride issue, but there's also her independence and her pride and her professional position in the world. I mean, I know she's my wife, but I mean, it's like if she wants to use her name, I'm okay with it. You know, if we have the kids, of course, you know, they will be Marins. Little Marin
exactly.
kids. And then, here's something really tweaky is I got a buddy who actually named, he gave his kid, this is a guy who's married to a woman, gave the kid her last name. And man, that pissed off that pissed off his grandfather. You know, I mean, I don't know to what end that is, but it was a decision that he made that to stop that name.
Right.
From, you know, but as far as just...
The name wouldn't be Bush or anything.
No.
Okay.
But the weird thing is that, you know, the other thing is if people don't know that she's married to me, like there was some blog entry on some comedy blog that said, Mishna Wolf, I don't know what her affiliation is with Marc Maron, but they seem to be close. I'm like, she's my wife! You know, what does that mean, you know? But I completely respect her desire to not be polluted with my.
Well,
you know, sometimes the Marin name is not always a noble thing.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's like you're married to that guy. That guy's crazy. That neurotic mess of need. You're married to that guy? No, it's okay. It's okay. You know, and now I'm not going to overthink it. So let's talk a little bit about we're going to talk about Congress when we come back and the changes and Tom DeLay, the sort of, you know, Napoleonic bug-killing lunatic that is in charge of that House right now. But before we get into that, so you had a good New Year's.
Yeah, it was pretty good. I can't complain. As a matter of fact, I want to give a special shout-out, if I mind.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
I don't mind at all.
To one Officer McDonald of the Suffolk County Police.
Okay.
Eastern of Long Island.
How are you? There's I don't know what we do. We don't have an official shout-out noise or anything else, but good morning, sir.
Yeah, I don't want to say a woman, actually.
It's a woman. All right, well, then I screwed up.
And I won't
good
go
morning,
into
man.
Why I know her, but, you know, I met her New Year's Eve.
Wayne, you're just full of mystery.
I certainly am, you know. We'll just leave it at that.
I
don't want her to think that everyone from the Bronx on the east end of Long Island are breaking into homes whenever we go out there. I just wanted to make that clear.
The cryptic Wayne Gelman is leaving signs and signals for all people that he knows out there. I can't even decipher what.
And please don't.
All right. So when we come back, we're going to get into some more of the mysterious Wayne Gelman's mind, but also we are going to talk about the Congress and what they plan on changing to make this less of a democracy than it already is. It is now 12 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air and online at morningsedition.com from Air America Radio.
Seventeen past the hour, Mark Maron here with Wayne Gelman. who's sitting for Mark Riley, who'll be back on Wednesday. I keep going back and forth between Gilman and Gelman. The weird thing is, when I grew up, in way back when, my grandmother lived in Pompey Lakes, New Jersey, there used to be a store called Gelman's.
And G-E-L. I think,
G-E. Gilman. G-I-L.
Right. Two L's, actually. Scottish.
Is it G-I-L-L?
L-L. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you don't have a Scottish accent.
No, I don't. No, no. You know, and by the way, I am black.
Whoa, surprises every second here in the studio. Thanks for telling me. I had no idea.
Right, yeah.
So my wife calls me, or I just called her to make sure everything she's all right. She goes, the reason I don't take your last name is we are in the same business, and I'd like to make my own mistakes, thank you.
My kind of woman.
she says, if I'm in a meeting as Misha Wolf, then there's not, I don't risk the possibility of getting any of your basic, garbage coming back at me. If I go in as Misha Mayer, and they're like, are you related to that idiot? Yeah, we know him. I don't think so. I'm reading into that. I'm reading my own insecurity into that. So I have a dream diary. When am I going to go back to the therapist? It's been weeks, man. They're stacking up, but this is last night. I got out of bed, and it was the new year. I feel great, full of insight. I take out a long golden quill, stick it in my gallbladder, and start writing down my predictions. We'll get Bush out of office this year. I know it. Dean will lead us back to the White House. The Republican attack machine won't be able to take him down with something ridiculous. The red states will finally realize the wisdom of our policies and come around. They secretly love the Northeast. They'll definitely get Bin Laden this year. How hard can it be to find a guy with his own TV studio? The 9/11 commission will clear everything up and Bush will have to comply. Gas prices will come down now that we've got Iraq. The oil should be cheap and cheap, right? Legal gay marriage will be embraced by every state. Who's really against that at this stage? The Yankees will win the World Series. What can happen? They're going to lose 4 in a row to the Red Sox? Oliver Stone's Alexander will be the masterpiece we've all waited for. No hurricanes this year. Go ahead and buy that sailboat. One problem, Reagan will probably be out there campaigning for Bush. Damn. And finally, Evan Cohen will make a great leader for Air America Radio. Really solid, really honest. I stop writing, and just then an albino dwarf in a swan costume skips up to me and slaps me across the face with a sea bass. He says, wake up, Mark. You've missed a year. 2004, it's over. I say, over? What happened? This happened. And he slaps me with the fish again. Bam! So I'm all woozy. Then after a few minutes, I come around and I start to remember all of last year. Ouch. Mm. I turn to the albino and say, thanks, buddy, for helping me remember. And then I picked up his fish and slap him senseless with it. Silly albino. I woke up and my bed was filled with ranch dressing, whatever that means. You know, Wayne, sometimes you got to let these things slide.
I see.
So there you go. So let's get into this. The Republican Congress led by the Napoleonic ex-bug killer, Tom DeLay, who is a criminal, supposedly. I think
not by Texas standards.
Yeah, whatever that means. Divvy up the country for our own purpose.
Right, exactly.
House Republicans already changed the party rules regarding party leadership. The new rule allows members indicted by grand juries to remain in a leadership post. It benefits Majority Leader Tom DeLay in case he is indicted by a Texas grand jury that has already indicted three of his political associates. I hope that the hammer comes down on the hammer. That's what I'm telling you. The original rule that forced leaders to step down if indicted was adopted by House Republicans in 93 in order to highlight Democrats' ethical lapses. So now that it's going to come back around, point the finger at them, they're going to dismantle it, which they did. Republicans wanted to make it harder to discipline lawmakers under House ethics rules. Violations would be limited to those found on a specific list of indiscretions. The standing rule against any behavior that might bring discredit on the chamber would be eliminated, and members would be held to a narrower standard. House members would be able to respond to any admonishment before a letter of complaint goes out to the Ethics Committee. An investigation into ethics violations would end if there is a tie vote. Republicans may change the rules to end the Democrats' filibuster of judicial nominations. Now, apparently, Wayne, the only thing, keeping this in line. Apparently Bill Frist can just say, it's a majority vote and that's it.
Right.
He can just say majority rules. Yeah. He can just say that.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing holding that, stopping that from happening is some sort of dignity. Is that
I don't even think dignity plays a role in this. You know, I don't think they have any shame. They don't care.
Then why haven't they done it? I guess there hasn't been a filibuster yet?
Well, not yet.
Okay.
You know, and I mean, and of course the fireworks start tomorrow as soon as the first session opens up. But the fact of the matter is that they've been treating this guy with kid gloves. His hands are, you know, full of blood on them.
Delay.
A different delay.
Yeah.
And the deal is that under normal circumstances, you know, he right now would have been facing indictment.
Right.
But they're doing things that's in their political best interest, what they consider expedient to maintain status quo.
Yes.
And he may very well get away with it.
Yeah, the Senate Republicans are trying to change the rules for committee funding. Also, Republicans are demanding that they are privy to 2/3 of the committee budgets. Democrats say the funding should proportionally reflect the breakdown of the Senate. So they're doing everything they can to, you know, to cut around any corner just to make
right.
it so the Democrats don't even matter
yeah.
in either house.
And the thing that really gets to me is that you have these people working for the Bush White House as spokespeople saying that, you know, the current president is not a lame duck president. He's very active.
Right.
Well, everything is rubber stamped.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, like, we're going to expect whatever he says goes the next 4 years, regardless of whatever Democrats may try to do to challenge it.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I find most disconcerting.
Well, you know, also, you know, this president, he may not be, you know, he's not, I guess, a lame duck president, but he is a lame president.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a guy that, you know, really, it seems that, especially it's something like when you're dealing with the tsunami relief issue,
mm-hmm.
is that this is a guy that, you know, doesn't do anything on his own volition. He doesn't
right.
innately react with any empathy or compassion
mm-hmm.
or even, you know, even with any intellectual vision whatsoever. I mean, this is a guy whose administration, right after the tsunami hit, and Bill Clinton was in England and said, you know, someone should take the lead on this. This is a horrible thing that's
right.
happening. As a diplomat, as a former American president who had a mic stuck in his face after an international catastrophe
yeah.
makes a comment about it. So the first line of thought that the Bush administration had after, you know, the tsunami happened on, I guess, on Tuesday afterwards was to say, you know, what right does Clinton have to shoot his mouth off? He was showboating.
Well,
he's got no power to do anything.
The thing is not only that, but it's just that Bush said that he didn't want to appear as if he was like Clinton, and I think the line was, I don't want to feel, you know, Clinton had the tendency to feel your pain.
Well,
you know?
Why not, though?
And I think you're being too kind. I think Bush, there's a certain level of arrogance. I think if a tsunami were to hit Crawford, Texas,
yeah.
he would wait 72 hours
if he
before
yeah. yeah.
you know, making the decision because he's going to try to find some sort of monetary expediency for not spending the money to save his own, if you will, you know, expletive.
Right.
But the bottom line is, it's just that the arrogance of this man, the arrogance of the administration,
but,
and
yeah.
the fact, you know, all right, he's in his last term, he doesn't have to do jack at this point, and he's got the Republican majority in the Congress.
Right.
That's it.
Well, here's the deal. That let's get back to this, and I'll get back to the Congress. That's a good pulling me back, because I was about to, you know, launch into this whole, you know, tsunami relief,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of the way they're politicizing that now.
And we should talk about that.
We will. I think we're going to do that at the top of the eight. But, you know, these people are now, it's you know, DeLay says that this is going to be probably the most productive 2 years of our Republican majority. This is a quote. It's not just Social Security and tax reform.
Mm-hmm.
It's tort reform. It's regulatory reform, restraining spendings, redesigning the House, redesigning the government, redesigning the uniforms that everyone will have to wear. I put that one at the end. Redesigning the state songs, redesigning the national song, redesigning the camps that we're going to put that. Whoa, slow
yeah,
down.
Right.
But there's a momentum that feels like that at times.
No question about it.
Now, apparently in Social Security, which, you know, is, you know, for most practical purposes, not broken,
mm-hmm.
according to many people.
Yeah.
Now the Republican is going to be the Republican Party with help from many different other groups, Progress for America for one, an independent conservative group, the National Association of Manufacturers for another group, are going to put millions and millions and millions of dollars into selling the idea to the American people that the Social Security system is broken.
Yeah. And it saddens me because, I mean, some of the nation's leading economists have already come forward and said that the Bush plan will not work.
In fact,
you know, that it will cost this government at least a good 10 to 15 years to recover.
$2 trillion,
right.
wasn't it?
Yeah, something to that effect.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading in yesterday's New York Times that there's now a bid by some members of the administration to give an impression that they're going to reconstruct what the deficit looks like so it wouldn't look so painful
mm-hmm.
by coming up with all sorts of gimmickry to say, you know, the way Clinton was able to hand over government in 1999 with a surplus,
right.
Bush is hoping to do the same at the end of his term.
Right.
You know, and the deal is the kind of plans that they're coming up with defy any kind of logic.
No, yeah, they're using old numbers, too.
Right.
I mean, this is the game.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's even with the tsunami relief. It's like they go from $15 million, which is nothing, $35
yeah.
million, which is nothing,
exactly.
$350 million, which, you know, relative to, the number of people we have in this country and what Japan is kicking, there seems to be some sort of, big pee-pee fight going on internationally about, who's going to throw in what kind
exactly,
of money.
Yeah.
But it's easy to pledge money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a government that has pledged money before. This is an administration.
Right.
And they don't show up to the pledge. They don't necessarily do what they're going to do. So they can cook books when it comes to deficit numbers, too. They can just keep saying
exactly.
whatever they want to say.
Right.
And then after all is said and done, it's like,
mm-hmm.
oh, my God, did someone just screw us? I guess so.
Well, the problem is that the American taxpayer is carrying the bag, and we'll be carrying it for some time. You know?
Right. And it's like it's baffling to me that, what they're going to do to try to honor, their buddies on Wall Street, the investment
mm-hmm.
community. This is what he's going to do
yeah.
to try and, to get the economy going is take, people who want to retire his money and put it on that roulette wheel. We'll be back. We'll be back with Peter Ross to talk about the pharmaceutical
right.
industry and how that's screwing everybody.
Mm-hmm.
28 past the hour, Air America Radio. Past the hour, Mark Maron sitting here with the one, the only, the legend, the professor, Wayne Gilman, co-hosting, sitting in for Mark Riley, who is still supposedly in England.
England, New Jersey.
I can't. You're making me think that
but
he's just
true.
Sitting out there.
I bet you, Mark Maron, if you were to go over to his house right now, you'd find him sitting at home, puffing on one of them nasty cigars in his.
He swears he's off of those.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no. Stop taking a Coca-Cola that.
Yeah, right. All right. All right, man. So I hear you're addicted to oatmeal. Is that true?
At this point in my life, I'm ashamed to say that I must take that to keep my parts in shape.
Yeah, I eat a lot of oatmeal myself. I'm a big fan
important.
Of oatmeal.
You're really.
So let's take this call. We have to. We do what we do whenever he calls for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Because, our president is openly operating in a different reality. We think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. You know him, you love him. So on the phone once again, it's hard to love him, but we do, for some reason. Planet Push correspondent, Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. It's God's new year, and he's dropping the ball on sin.
Okay.
Bam!
All right, good. All right, buddy. Well, happy
New Year.
Yes. Happy,
hello.
Yes, happy New Year to you. So, so I bet a lot of our listeners would like to know, Lawton, if you've made any resolutions.
Resolutions?
Have you made any promises to improve yourself in the coming year, Lawton?
Improve myself, Mark. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. God don't make no junk.
All right. Okay. Well, is there anything you'd like to achieve, maybe? Any goals in the coming year, Lawton?
Well, sure. First, I'd like to be able to levitate certain household objects with my mind. But, if I can't do that, in the months ahead, I'm going to try to do everything I can to privatize Social Security.
You mean...
Get on that.
All right. You mean giving away protected money to enrich Wall Street at the expense of senior citizens, yes?
That's what I just said. I think you might be losing your hearing.
Right.
If I want to get that check this year, Mark. But
okay.
I tell you,
yeah,
here's another thing I'd really love to do in the coming year.
Okay.
I'd like to end the war in Iraq.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. I wouldn't have expected you to say that. I'm glad to hear you say
yes,
that, Lawton.
Absolutely. We need to move on from Iraq.
Uh-huh.
So we can fight holy wars in Iran, China, and North Korea,
no, no,
Canada.
No.
Boy, that
no.
is a liberal hellhole.
No.
Canada.
So wait. So now,
wow.
I guess what you're saying here is when a great superpower like America is engaged in
hellhole.
Only one war, we're being underachievers. Is that what you're saying there?
You do hear me.
Yeah,
you don't have to get your hair checked at all, do you?
All right.
But Mark, okay, another thing. Maybe
yeah.
I'm a dreamer.
Yeah.
But in 2005 is the year we can end racial hatred in America.
No kidding. Well, that's great. Really. Really?
It.
Yeah.
I got a plan here. The way to do this, you get rid of all the races that people don't like.
Whoa,
rid of it.
Start
with a Mexican.
No. Whoa.
Huh?
Come on, man. You're better than that.
Hellhole.
You're better than that.
Huh?
You're better than that.
Oh,
right? You're not getting
rid of
any
Mexican. All right, now that one was just a hobby, but I got something much more ambitious
right.
up my sleeve.
Yeah.
In 2005, I want to welcome the latest member of the right-wing Republican Christians and a full-blown citizen of Planet Bush. Mark Maron.
Whoa, whoa, dude.
Yeah, welcome,
brother. Dude, do you really
Come on in. I'll teach you the handshake.
Do you really think I have what it takes?
Handshake.
Do you think I have what it takes to be totally delusional?
Hang on.
I mean, come on.
Hang on. Here's the pitch.
Right.
The Council of Good White People already accepted you.
Okay.
All right. We got a condo all picked out for you. We got a closet full of pleated dockers already bought for you.
Oh, God.
We're going to need to take a photo ID so you can get into the food court at the mega church. But other than that, buddy, you are good to go.
You know what?
We got it all set up for
you.
It's
nice to know that the food court, they have a food court at the mega church, but I don't think so. I appreciate it.
Well, okay. It's a tall order.
Yeah.
I like to, you know, set goals for myself, but if I can convert just one person, one solitary individual to the cause of conservatism, do you know what that would mean?
What, Lawton?
Would you have a failure? I was a little failure.
Yeah.
One person.
Yeah, let it out.
Convert an entire state.
Yeah. All right, so look.
I'm nothing.
All right, come on, Lawton. Come on, buddy. It's the new year, buddy. It's a time of new beginnings, my friend. All right, 2005 could be the year that you break through and convert millions of people. Okay, buddy? All right, so just take it easy. All right?
Starting with you?
No, no way, man. All right, I'm not going to do it. You know, but I'm not going to do it, but you can still call in because it's important. We can still talk.
Really? I call every time I want?
Well, you know, within reason. Yeah, all right. Yeah, sure.
Well, if you move in next door to me on Planet Bush, I won't need to call.
No, I'm not
you
gonna.
Just drop by the house,
no.
We'll cook up some ribs,
no.
And watch Passion of the Christ on DVD.
No.
I got the director's
No, stuff. It's going to
be extra bloody.
It's going to be
extra bloody.
It's going to be a long
year.
Oh,
it's a good time.
All right. Thanks, Lawton.
It's all set up for you. God loves you.
All right, yes.
God loves you.
All right.
Happy New Year.
Goodbye, mister.
You too, Wayne.
Yeah, right.
Bye-bye, buddy.
No room for diversity in your program.
Man, always uplifting and disturbing to talk to a Lawton Smalls, isn't
it? And he seems to like you. And I thought you were one of us.
Wait a minute. That's what happens, Wayne, when you give people enough airtime, they assume they're your friend.
Yeah.
Here we
go.
So now on the phone, this is, I'm very excited about this interview. Mm. It's very interesting. He is a VP of marketing at Pfizer. He's speaking as a private citizen, not for Pfizer.
Mm.
I'd like to put that out there. Pfizer has different views than our guest. I want to talk to him about drug companies, which is why he's with us. Peter Rost, how are you?
I am fine. Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show.
It's Peter Rost, right?
That is right.
Well, I'm glad to talk to you because, you know, the drug companies are screwing everybody. So you were on the news, you know, back in October for supporting the importation of Canadian drugs. Why are you speaking out against the industry that you still work for, first of all?
Well, actually, I don't think I'm necessarily speaking out against the industry. I think that the current leadership is simply making really some big business mistakes. When you have most of your customers not trusting you, that's not a good thing for any company. But also, I think this is the right thing to do. We have 50, 60, 70 million people without insurance for drugs, and they can't always afford drugs. And when you can't do that, you sometimes die, you sometimes get very sick. It's a terrible situation.
So now let me ask you something about Bush's Medicare drug policy. Do you know about that? How does that work? How does that put the Medicare availability of medicines for people on Medicare in the hands of pharmaceutical companies?
Well, the Medicare drug policy, initially it means that you have all these different drug cards. I think there are 60, 70 of those cards. But it still means that somebody who buys a drug using one of those cards pay two times as much, three times as much as the Veterans Administration pays for the same drug. Usually elderly people on a low income. Then you have coming up in 2006 when the government is going to start purchasing drugs for Medicare recipients under the benefit. Problem with that is there's an interesting little provision in the bill saying the government is not allowed to negotiate drug prices.
Okay.
Which is pretty counterintuitive, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it sounds like it. So this does this mean that that people who are older, as you said, that they're jacking up the prices for the elderly? Are they just trying to deplete these poor old people's bank accounts of everything before they die, so they have nothing to leave anybody?
Well, there are two sides to that thing. Number one is if you have a drug bill, if you pay about $4,000 each year for drugs,
yes,
you're still going to end up paying $3,000 yourself. So the government's going to cover $1,000. But the second part is, I thought we had a Republican government that didn't like high taxes, right?
Right, yeah.
And what we end up with here is the taxpayers paying a higher price than they would have had to pay for those drugs if the government was allowed to negotiate. That doesn't make sense, does it?
No.
Mr. Ross, Wayne Gilman here. I just wanted to ask you, it seems like more and more states now and local governments are moving or they're espousing use of the Canadian drugs as a means to help out those poor American consumers who can't afford what the going rate is right now. Do you think that's going to a condition that will prevail throughout the country, that the Bush administration will lose this battle against that sort of action?
It's hard to tell. Actually, what's going on right now, and this was on the front cover of the USA Today last week, and this has been pretty much unnoticed so far in the U.S., is that after President Bush visited Canada, the health minister in Canada and the government in Canada has started to speak out against importation of drugs from Canada to the U.S., and there are some important decisions coming up here in a couple of weeks. They may even decide to shut down that trade of drugs coming in from Canada. Clearly, then you have the possibility from other markets, but there is some movement going on right now to possibly take away this. And if that happens, I would imagine that's the safety valve right now. And I imagine if that happens, you could have a bit of an explosion in the U.S.
Wow. So, Peter Ross, we want to when we come back from our break, I want to know how the pharmaceutical companies, you know, jack up prices. I also want to know a little bit about research and how they use the explanation of research to sort of, you know, push cheaper drugs off of the market. We'll talk about all that when we come back. Our guest is Peter Ross from Pfizer. It's 44 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, fighting treason with reason on Air America Radio.
Hi, we're back at 49 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I am Mark Maron. That's Wayne Gilman.
All my life.
All your life.
Right.
Wayne Gilman has been him. You might know him. There's a small cult of Gilman out there who want to know more about Wayne Gilman. And today is your big opportunity. On the phone with us, Peter Ross is the VP of marketing at Pfizer, doing some anti-marketing, I might add. Peter, let me ask you this question. The pharmaceutical industry always says that it has to charge a lot for drugs because it costs so damn much to research, to get the research done for new medications. Now, how much of this is BS?
Well, all of it.
So they're just saying that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, the deal is this. Pharmaceutical companies spend about twice as much on profit as what they spend on research. They also spend about twice as much on marketing and selling as they spend on research. So research is by far... it's not at all the largest expense, but there's something else that's important to remember. What's called research and what you care about in research, which is getting new drugs, is not necessarily what's in that research budget, because a big part of that budget is only there really to develop line extensions, to have like patent protection for existing drugs.
Let me understand that. So you're saying that all they do is they just sort of reinvent a pre-existing drug a little bit to renew the patent, so less expensive generic drugs have a harder time getting out to the people.
A significant part of the research budget is spent for that, yes.
Wow. Now, can I ask you a weird question? Are they inventing diseases, the pharmaceutical industry?
Well, it's funny you should say that, but some people do claim that that is the case. It doesn't happen that often, but now and then, yeah, the new syndromes and so on are some people claim that.
That they're manufactured to promote new drugs.
Right.
The thing that gets to me, Mr. Ross, is the fact that they are basically sending out so many drugs into the marketplace without adequate testing. There was a time that at least a good decade would go by before a drug would hit the market. Is it because there's a huge demand on the part of Americans? I mean, we're in a permanent press society. We want things like lickety-split. Is it that, or is it the fact that, you know, it's in, expedient for the pharmaceuticals to get the drugs out?
Well, there are a couple of points to that. I'm not sure if it's done without adequate testing. Clearly, FDA's approval times, the time it takes for them to get a new drug on the market, have gone down. I'm not so sure that their standards have gone down. What has really happened here are a couple of other things. Any drug coming on the market has a certain risk. And when I went to medical school 20, 25 years ago, we were told to be very careful with any new drugs simply because you didn't really know until a large number of patients had tried them if there were any very rare but still dangerous side effects. So you had to be careful with the new drugs. Now, this kind of behavior seems to have gone out the window, and doctors today, I'm not sure if they care about it because the uptake on some new drugs is very large. And that's obviously driven also by direct-to-consumer advertising and the marketing. But that also means you have situations such as Merck's Vioxx, where all of a sudden you discover lots of patients with heart attacks. But things are going a little bit too rapidly in the uptake of patients. I'm not sure if that's entirely the FDA's fault. Now, there is another issue, though. In connection with David Graham's testimony last year, this FDA scientist who had some concerns about how the FDA operates, a few weeks later, or a month later, a report was published that this was an internal survey that had been done within the FDA 2 years ago, and apparently 18% of the scientists at the FDA, 18% said that they had felt pressured to approve a drug that they didn't feel had the efficacy or safety that was needed. And that's pretty scary. What's even more scary was about two-thirds of the researchers said that they didn't feel comfortable with FDA's surveillance and FDA's methods to ensure safety of our drugs.
So the FDA, what you're saying, has been sort of co-opted by the pharmaceutical lobby.
I'm not sure if that is the case or not. Some people, again, do claim that. But the internal survey here of the FDA people, the ones who should really know, clearly indicates that something is going on within the FDA. There is push to approve new drugs, and some people feel pressured.
So what? I was about to ask, why is the medical community not rebelling against this? I mean, why aren't they saying more, or are they?
Well, it's a good question. I think, unfortunately, we have a situation today where a lot of doctors have, quite frankly, stopped practicing medicine, and they've all become little business people who are trying to satisfy their customers and not looking at them as patients. The customers who may come in and ask for a particular drug that they've seen in direct-to-consumer advertising. Good medicine is not always practiced.
So now the doctors, aren't they also offered, bonus packages, gifts, benefits from pushing certain drugs, prescribing? Let me say prescribing.
There might be there are very significant limitations on what can be offered. Clearly, there are sometimes violations, but yes, you have drug reps, nice looking male and female drug reps coming in every second day, offering pizzas, breakfast,
whatever.
There is a lot of pressure, and some doctors refuse to see drug reps. Others, most of them, do happily see them.
Now, what about how much of this? This is a weird question, and I know this has been out there in the culture too, but it's always sort of eaten at me. Is it within the pharmaceutical industry's interest to actually cure disease?
It's kind of like a very big question, I guess. If you don't cure disease, you're not going to sell your drugs. So it's in your interest to cure disease. Clearly, do you sell more drugs if you have more sick people? Yes, you do. So I'm not quite sure how to answer the question.
Now, as a still working VP of marketing at Pfizer, how are you keeping your job and having these conversations?
Well, I've been very careful not even commenting on Pfizer or what's going on with Pfizer, but I can say what's been pretty widely publicized is the Congress, U.S. Congress, did write a letter to the CEO of Pfizer when they started investigating me for speaking out, and I haven't been called in for more investigations since then, and also the New Jersey Justice Department called me in for an interview to ask what was going on since some of the things that have been done might violate certain criminal laws. So it's been quiet after that, but clearly without the letter from Congress and without Justice Department, it may have been a different situation.
Yeah, so but everything's okay at work? No.
You're not uncomfortable there? They have not put you in an isolated office somewhere?
Well, I'm going to be careful and not comment too much about the internal situation. I think that's one of the things I have to abide by is not comment about Pfizer, what goes on within Pfizer. That's how I'm also keeping my job.
Okay, well, I certainly appreciate you joining us, Peter Ross, VP of Marketing at Pfizer. It was good talking to you. You have a good day.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, take care. Mm. Well, that was kind of scary.
It's hard advice from the hand that feeds you, though.
Just the issue of, you know, the money involved in treatment. Everyone's going to get sick, Wayne.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, everyone's going to be on pills. And,
yeah.
You know, and also just the idea that, you know, they could, you know, really invent syndromes. And the idea that most of what they're doing in terms of research is just to update patents so reasonably priced medications cannot get into the hands of people that need them. I find it incredibly disturbing.
It is, and it's very disconcerting, and I've seen some of them in action. You know, I go to my doctor's office, not to, you know, expose her, but basically I've seen them walk in from the companies and how they sell, and unfortunately you get stuck,
yep.
Caught up in it. I understand we may have the Reverend Jesse Jackson with us in the following.
Oh, is that? Are you, that's right. You can get him on the phone.
Right,
okay.
I'll try to.
Okay, so look forward to that. Jesse Jackson, Jeff Jarvis later in the hour, and we're going to talk about Tsunami as well. It's 58 past the hour on Air America Radio.
On Air America Radio.
Hi, I'm Mark Maron here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, part-time Buddhists and yoga fiends, all of you. Welcome. Welcome to the large umbrella that is Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I hope you're having a good new year. And it, God knows it's only been, what, 3 days? If it's already screwed up, then you're in trouble. Then I have to say that you're off to a bad start, but I hope you're not. I had a hard time being optimistic. My guest host today, you know, and it's a privilege for me because I see him every day, and I've actually gotten the opportunity to get to know him this morning. Mark Riley is on vacation in England. That's a legitimate vacation. He will be back on Wednesday. Joining me in the room today.
That's where England is, huh?
Wayne Gilman.
Okay.
Yeah, who insists that Riley's just sitting in New Jersey in bed.
Right. Smoking the stogie.
He's not. You know the guy a lot longer than me, Gilman.
I have. I'll be honest. You know,
yeah, I get the feeling. I could tell by the day before he left, he was going somewhere on a plane because he doesn't like to fly, and he was pretty shaky
nervous about
that. Oh,
yeah. You know, that's his M.O.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So, but you had a pretty good New Year, as you said.
Yeah, I did. You know, very quiet. I mean, nothing terribly exciting. You know, I like to watch paint dry. I have a little sideline.
Yeah.
Do a little construction on the side.
Uh-huh.
And I guess there's a sense of accomplishment with me whenever I get into this creative mode to do some construction.
You really do? You're serious?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I
thought he'd pull my leg.
No, I'm just serious about this.
You really did watch paint dry?
Yeah. And I hung sheetrock and I changed a couple of pipes.
You got rid of a tenant?
Yeah.
How do you? Oh, really?
Well, you know, I don't know if I'm permitted to actually, because I know you always hawk your public appearances. I have apartments that I can hawk.
Yeah?
I accept Section 8.
Okay.
Would you like to move to South Bronx?
How much are they going for?
Well, you know, we could work out something.
All right. Let me ask you a question, Wayne Gilman, construction master.
Yes.
When you have plaster walls,
right,
and you want to put sheetrock up, how much plaster is there that you got to pull down?
Well, actually, sometimes, depending on the integrity of the plastered wall,
yeah,
it would be in your best interest to put joint compound on the wall
and just
go right over it, laminate over the...
With sheetrock. Oh,
right.
No kidding.
You know, and just tape it if you're skillful.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out what I'm going to do because, you know, I'm in this apartment here.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I don't, you know, when my wife moves out here, what we're going to do with that house, I don't know, but I'm trying to decide whether or not I'm just going to... Because I got pretty good deal. It's
right
in Queens. It's real convenient.
Uh-huh.
And it's still under, you know, it's still under $1,000 for a two-bedroom, which is
really
crazy.
Really? For a two-bedroom?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering if I should just dump some money into that apartment and just, you know, go ahead and take the hit and just make
well,
it exactly
weird.
What I want.
Did you know someone prior that the
it was,
you know,
no, it was
the two-bedroom
in Queens? It's Astoria.
Really?
And this was, you know, this was, a, I got in it 6 years ago when it was like $850. You know, so it's only going up incrementally because it's stabilized. But it's one of those decisions like, do I put a bunch of money into an apartment that I'm never going to own to live comfortably, or do I just put together some money and buy something?
Well, we should talk after the show. I could probably bring something.
You don't think this
that,
is the time
know.
For it to do the talk?
Yeah. Actually, you should just move on. You know, I mean, if there were ever, God forbid, a tsunami in New York, you know, the Bronx would be probably the safest place to be because it's part
the
of
Bronx,
the it's part of the U.S. mainland. Everything else is an island.
Okay. Well, all right. So I'm moving to the South Bronx.
We have the Reverend Jesse Jackson standing.
We
by.
Do. He's going to be. He's a friend of yours.
Right.
And we're going to talk to him about the passing of Shirley Chisholm, who was on Saturday at 80. She passed away. She was Brooklyn's from Brooklyn's 12th congressional district originally in 1968, and she of course ran for president in 1972. I'd like to welcome the Reverend Jesse Jackson to the show. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, guys. On this. Exciting and yet very sad day for all of us.
Certainly is, Reverend Jackson. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And your earliest remembrances of the late Shirley Chisholm?
You know, we came out of the Selma, Alabama in 1965, 40 years ago this year. There was some kind of breakthrough, people. That was DeCatch who broke through as a mayor in Gary. Now, that was a big deal for us at that time. And then Carl Stokes, the breakthrough in Cleveland. And then Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman to break through into the Congress. And Shirley Chisholm was a freedom fighter and a politician to seek. I mean, she never chose politics in terms of joining the club over freedom fighting. For the speaking out against the war in Vietnam, the Democratic Party itself, or the Republican Party, she often said her strongest weapon, the most threatening weapon she had, was her mouth. That is to say that she sent the would not be, she said in her autobiography, not bought, said not bought. So she was that kind of rambunctious, strong woman who, once you knew her, you always have her etched into your memory.
Reverend Jackson, did she play a role in terms of inspiring you? Because there was a time when she ran for the presidency back in 1972, and you followed her as perhaps the second most formidable black in the country to actually pursue that lofty height in the early 80s.
Well,
was she one of the inspiration?
Again, coming out of Selma in 65 and 72, there were a number of discussions going around the country with Carl Stokes and Chairman Percy Sutton, and Hatch and others about the idea of a black running in the primary. So while we discussed it, we looked up and Shirley did it. She just broke out the pack, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And she made it happen. A huge breakthrough for women, for independent politics. There was something about Shirley Chisholm that was just, she was just determined to be a freedom fighter, which made her, I would say, different than most politicians, they do good work, and they adjust to what they're doing. And once they, get into the cycle of growth, they become traditional, in many ways, politicians. That's not pejorative, frankly. That's what people do. But Shirley was a freedom fighter in a politician seat. She never adjusted to that club. But she changed it, indeed.
Reverend Jackson, changing the subject just a little bit. Now, is there a protest in Ohio today for against voter fraud and some activism that's going on?
There is a major protest in Ohio today. The schemes to disenfranchise voters in Ohio are greater than those in Florida. For example, two cities in Perry County. Certified elections with 124% turnout. Try that for arithmetic. The exit polling in Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania was so far beyond the margin of error, unlike any other place in the country, until statisticians say it would be 100 million to one odds it would have happened. The exit polling was that far off in Ukraine. We supported a re-election. But here we had more than just exit poll gaps. You had machines, deal bowl and triad machines owned by partisans where you had no audit trail.
Yeah.
And you have to take them on face value. I mean, try that on for stupid.
So this is a nationwide protest in Florida, Ohio, Boston.
in San Francisco. You can get information at www.redefeatbush.com. Thank you, Reverend Jackson,
well,
for joining
what
us. Yes.
That on Thursday, urge your senator to stand with Congressman Conyers and Congressman Jackson and the Black Caucus, Congresswoman Waters. Urge your senator to stand up and make this a hearing debate in Washington. They cannot do again in 2004 what they did in 2000. Senators Clinton and Reid and John Kerry must stand up this time around.
So write your senator, or write those three senators at the very least. Thank you, Reverend Jackson.
Call them today.
Okay, well, then we'll try and post that information on our website to call those senators. We appreciate you being with us.
Thank you.
You take care. It's 15 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio. This is Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blogs. MorningSedition.com. Courtesy of Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 20 past the hour. Mark Maron. That's Wayne Gilman sitting over there in Riley's chair today. Riley, of course, is sitting somewhere in England, New Jersey.
So he claims. Right. And as Liz Winston
keeps cracking me up that Gilman insists.
He's home. I know him. I know his M.O.
But do you know he's home?
I know. If you call his house now, you know the way you called your wife? You'll probably get the answering service, but, you know, I know he's home. And as Liz Winstead would say, he is smoking and stogie and masticating.
Oh, come on. We're gonna try and call him. Because I know. But you know what? His wife is up, Kim, right? She's up listening to the show every day.
Every day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I just don't, I imagine.
I'm surprised she hasn't called me yet.
Just to see what he's up to?
Right.
Go tell Mark to shut up. Did she ever call you to tell him to?
Certainly. You know,
come
please.
On. You're killing me here. All right, let me do this palm pilot. This came from Ramon earlier wearing a, it was like a Cuban shirt.
Oh, that's what it
was. I don't know what that was, yeah. 8 a.m., prepared to travel to South Asia. This is, oh, by the way, Colin Powell's palm pilot. Thank you, Kayla. I'm sorry. I didn't want to just have a vague palm pilot out there in the world. All right, Colin Powell's palm pilot. 8 a.m., prepared to travel to South Asia to inspect tsunami damage. Note, why is it never, hey, Colin, why don't you go over to Monaco and check out the situation there? 9 a.m., have limo pick up Jeb Bush. Buy stuff to keep him occupied on a long plane trip. Game Boy, crayons, Vicodin, latest issues of Maxim, Stuff, and FHM. 11 a.m. Note, only 2 weeks left at this job. Now I can say things to Jeb like, yeah, I dropped the ball at Times Square 3 nights ago, and your brother's been dropping the ball for the past 4 years. Go ahead, squeal on me. What are you going to do? 8 p.m. arrive in Thailand. Note to Jeb, even though it's spelled P-H-U-K-E-T, it's pronounced Phuket. 10 p.m. Keep Jeb from saying things to the locals like, well, this is bad, but you should see what the hurricanes did to some of our golf courses down around Boca. Ouch. 11:30 p.m. Promise officials more aid money. Note, if they don't like $350 million, yeah, make it $750 million or a billion, whatever. I'm out of here in 2 weeks. You can keep Jeb, too. There you go. That's
Colin Powell.
We were just talking about Christmas presents briefly. Clutch Larson is back, and he was, of course, talking about the any number of comic books he got because, you know, he's at that age where you like comic books. 38.
At that age.
My wife gave me something. Now, I'm not a technophobe, but I realized something about myself because I'm like, I'm not going to get an iPod. I don't need an iPod. You know what I mean? I'm not going to get this. I don't need that. But you know what? It's really because I just get daunted by, you know, what it takes to learn how to do something new. My wife got me this thing called the Pod 2. Kayla, you listening?
Yeah, I'm listening.
It's a Pod 2. It's a guitar toy. It's a box, all right, that's got all these knobs on it. And and apparently, like, I play guitar a lot at home. But she gave me this thing. And I don't use boxes. I'm sort of a purist, right? But she got me this thing. You can get, like, there's like 32 different amp sounds on it. From the history of music, what they have done is a bunch of techies have gotten together and through the history of rock and roll guitar playing have talked to professionals about which amps make the best tone, which combinations make the best tone. So they've literally gotten, you know, there's 32 presets on there of all the classic rock guitar tones from over the past 30 or 40 years.
That's amazing.
It is, and I'm like, nah, it doesn't work. And I was on that thing, like, we're watching TV, and then she's like, wait till the commercial. Because I was like, you know, I had no idea
like, you know, I play okay. You know, I've been playing a long time. I'm kind of stuck in whatever it is I do, my little pentatonic blues world of Marc Maron. But, man, just the putting it through a different sound, you're like, oh, that's how those guys do it? I mean, I could sound, you know, it's all games,
it's
toys.
It's amazing what happens.
That's
all technology. It's
a good time. What'd you get? Anything stand out?
Well, nothing I can discuss on the air. But I understand that you gave Jonathan Larson a comic book.
What else do you give that guy?
I don't know, you know.
But yeah, I give him a lofty comic book.
Really?
He gets the sort of mainstream sort of like, well, and they're smart comic books, but they're still out there. The one I got him was sort of an off the beaten track by this guy Chris Ware, who does the Billy Corgan, the Smartest Boy Alive stripped. Jimmy Corrigan, the Smartest Boy Alive strip, and this is a big book called Quimby the Mouse, and it's just a very ornate, bordering on almost schizophrenic detail it's more of an art book than it
really?
Is a comic book almost, yeah. So I think we should talk about the hurricane a bit, or the tsunami. I mean, yeah. Because one of the largest U.S. military relief operations in history is underway, and it's weird when the president, or when something happens, even though right out of the gate, his first reaction to this, the administration, there wasn't a reaction other than to badmouth Clinton for saying something.
Yeah.
And then $15 million, which was embarrassing. $35 million, still embarrassing.
Right.
And now out of nowhere, because I think of our pressure on him, Air America,
exactly.
Morning Sedition, because we were the only show on the air last week, we put the pressure on. And it went up to $350 million, the pledge, which is still, Japan went up to $500 million. I don't know who's going to win this thing. But Japan put in $4 per person, and we still are at $1.25 per person. And as I said, it's hard for me to talk, to say that they ever do the right thing about anything. So, I will sort of focus on the negatives a bit, but apparently there is a lot of mobilization on behalf of the international community to get relief to where it needs to be gotten as quickly as possible, and they're having some success with this.
Well, what bothers me, Mark, is the fact that there has to be so much pressure, just to get him to move, to get off the dime.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if this had occurred in Texas, I would, as I said earlier on, I would think that perhaps he would not even think twice. But knowing his personality, he'd probably try to find some sort of financial angle to withhold giving money to his own state.
Well, that's a good question, Wayne, as to whether or not that this number was brought upon because there were calls made to American contracting companies that could turn a profit off of this situation of rebuilding. Now, I have no proof of that, but I it's not unreasonable to suggest that about this particular administration.
Well, look what they've done in Iraq.
Exactly.
Also, I mean, it's a classic example.
And also to suggest. Alongside of that is how are they going to politicize this? I mean, it took them a week to have a reasonable human response to an international disaster that the likes I've never seen.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're sending they're sending Bill Frist over there. They're sending Colin Powell to Bill Frist, a doctor who's going to make assessments, who's been on TV,
right.
Speaking as a doctor.
Yeah.
That the way they're going to politicize this and make themselves out to be this sort of globally concerned.
And his brother. I mean, what's that about? I mean, I think he's just already putting in an early call because he's being considered for 2008 as possibly.
God forbid.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, I can't imagine it.
But it could actually happen.
I mean, this guy, like you said earlier in the show, that, the arrogance of this administration is just mind-bending.
Yeah.
That, that they would do something as insecure as the first words out of their mouth, this administration, about this particular disaster was Clinton's got a big mouth.
Right. That's it.
I mean, what is that?
And will they ever leave him alone at this point? I mean, there's so much envy and jealousy there.
Just, in England doing whatever he was
doing.
Exactly. Why wouldn't they ask him? And he said the right thing. He has a heart.
Yeah, he's sensitive.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
So we'll be back with Jeff Jarvis to talk about maybe the media and the tsunami, tsunami of media. after this, it's 28 past the hour on Morning Sedition.
On Air America Radio.
Good morning, 34 past the hour. It's Marc Maron here with my special superstar guest host Wayne Gilman in the seat for Mark Riley, who will be back next, or this Wednesday, supposedly, back
really?
From his long trip to...
Watch. He will try to extend his vacation.
Come on, no.
I know, Riley.
He's in England.
Yeah, England, New Jersey.
Oh, man. Well, we'll be with Jeff Jarvis in just a second. We know things are tough in the job market right now, so we've decided to help out. We scanned through the Sunday Help Wanted listings and found this for our Morning's Edition Monday job listing. There you go. There they are. We need a punch-up specialist. In a few weeks, our chief executive has to make two oral presentations to consumers, i.e., the general public, about the state of recent ventures. The most glaring of these involves a botched invasion. We are looking for someone to punch up the presentations in a way that avoids harsh-sounding terms such as botched invasion. We want to emphasize that we are not looking for someone to lie, per se. Think of your job as like that of a real estate agent who makes a house seem more appealing by spraying the smell of baking chocolate chip cookies in the kitchen. We just need someone skilled enough in the use of rhetorical devices to make an ugly bloodbath seem more like a marginally successful bloodbath. The way that the statement is phrased should make it obvious how badly we need help. Essentially, what we're looking for is someone who can make a certain Middle Eastern country smell like chocolate chip cookies. Anybody? Can you help out? So right now, it's our pleasure to bring our regular media consultant, analyst, critic guy. He's the editor of BuzzMachine.com, former TV critic for TV Guide and People, creator of Entertainment Weekly, though he does not see dime one from that. Right, Jeff?
That's
Jeff
right.
Really?
Oh, no. I'm an idiot. I'm a fool. Yeah, I failed the IQ test.
Was it your fault?
It was my fault.
Oh, really? Mm. You just let it go?
Yeah.
Oh, well. So let's get into the only story on anything is the tsunami. And do you feel that the media gave Bush a pass in terms of how he handled the response, the lack of response, the evolution of the response?
Well, it took 3 days for Bush to respond, and it took about that long for the story to get politicized as well, and it's been politicized since. And that's the problem I have, is that this is not about politics. It's about helping people.
Right. Right.
End of story.
Okay.
That's it, right? So the Times, the third day, came out and said, Bush is being dumb about this. Right, that's fine.
The third day being
the third day after the disaster.
So it was
last week. Tuesday. Tuesday, yeah.
Okay.
And they said, the reason he should be giving a lot of money is to make friends with Muslims over there.
Mm.
Well, that didn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
No, and it's not going to work either. It was trying desperately to turn this into a political angle. No, the angle is very simple. The angle is there's only one angle. You do it because it's right.
Okay.
You do as much as you can because you can. And so, yeah, I think that it works both ways. I think that on one hand, setting Jeb Bush for his presidential candidacy in 2008 is politicizing this event. Trying to argue the way the Times did is politicizing this event. They should all just shut up and worry about the people who are suffering there.
Well, it's stuck in my craw, Jeff, is that, that Clinton, by some weird coincidence, was in England and was, addressed by the English press as to, what he felt. He was there, and he immediately responded, saying, this is horrible, it's horrendous, somebody should take the lead in this.
Right.
And the first response out of the Bush administration before the president actually said anything was, what the hell, Bill Clinton can't put his money where his mouth is anymore, and our president didn't want to just pay lip service to something. It was really, that to me was the most shameful moment.
Clinton, as is his wont, played the role of a statesman.
Right, exactly.
You think about this. This was not hard to advise Bush. You're going to give him a script. Give him the right script. The right script says, immediately as soon as this happens, you come out and you say, my God, this is horrible. We're going to do whatever we can. We're going to look at that, and we're going to see what that is over time. So you buy yourself the time to go from 10 to 35 to 350.
Well, why does it take so long for him to get it, to connect the dots?
I guess somebody's got to write the script. It takes time, which it shouldn't. It's so obvious.
He doesn't know somebody. He doesn't know how he should feel about things because he's pathologically narcissistic
and humanitarian
and incapable of real empathy.
What about family values? I mean, he talks about that all the time. Isn't this part of that?
Let me say something controversial about this, because I was looking at, and I blogged this morning.
Hold on, let me hit the record button.
Yeah. But, it's controversial in this room probably.
Okay.
But, God help us, 150,000 people or more have died by the Indian Ocean. Last month or a month ago, Tony Blair said that 400,000 bodies have been found in Saddam Hussein's mass graves.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, the issue in Iraq was not WMD and it wasn't terrorism. It was a humanitarian issue. And the Bush White House didn't play that right either.
Right.
Right? That that's what I could stand behind is rescuing people from a tyrant, mm-hmm. rescuing them now from terrorism and death.
Yeah, but his father turned his back on that as well.
Amen. Exactly. Yeah. But same here. This is a humanitarian issue, and when you leave that turf, when you leave simple human sympathy, you're going to get in trouble. You're going to be wrong. You're going to do the wrong thing, say the wrong thing.
Well, I think what happened over the time, even though it's late, and for some reason the media is very forgiving with this particular president when it takes him a long time to get anything right.
Because they're dealing with ignorance. They know the man is ignorant. That's why they forgive him.
Right. I think that Karl Rove eventually did say something to him. I think they said, look, you can make the number whatever you want. Let's go. You don't just go from 35 million to 350 million because there's some sort of logic or evolution.
It ain't your money. They have a number.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Somebody said, what the hell? It's going to take $2 trillion to make Social Security like you want it. You're not going to tell anybody about that. You say you're going to balance the budget. Throw the money around. Cook the books. What the hell difference does it make?
Yeah.
You don't have to. The victims of the earthquake in Bam, Iran last year are still living in tents because the U.S. hasn't even materialized the amount of pledge then.
Right.
I mean, same with in Africa. He announced a Millennium Challenge account to give African countries development assistance of up to $5 billion, but the account hasn't dispersed anything yet.
And Clinton was right. There is a need for leadership here,
yes.
which they did finally come out with that, too, and work with Japan and India, I believe it is, to try to coordinate some of the stuff because it's very necessary. We should have done that from day one. If we're going to act like the world leader, then we've got to take the role immediately.
And they are doing it. And again, it's hard for me to say anything good, and I'm not even going to say it about the Bush administration, but there are a couple of thousand Marines out there distributing goods. There have been some vessels dispatched to the region, and they are having success in getting supplies where they're needed.
And as the media says, the irony of it is it's our largest military operation in Southeast Asia since you know what.
Yeah.
So it is a little bit odd for us to be back there, but this is the right way to be there.
The people are already dead.
Yeah. And other than that, I'm just glad that we know that a supermodel is safe.
Yeah.
That's been the big coverage in media here. And I don't mean that she lost her boyfriend, Petra Vankova, and she is gorgeous, and I don't mean to make light of her own suffering, but for God's sakes, this last week, the Daily News, that was their big story, just as the story is emerging about how awful this tragedy is, and they put a supermodel on the cover. And the New York Post, of course, matches it today because they have the supermodel's first picture on their cover. Petra Nemkova there in her hospital room, looking darn good, by the way.
But did you see the tastelessness? What was it, Kay? Well, the Daily News on the website had her posing for her swimsuit like there was a tsunami was everywhere, and she's waist deep in water, smiling with her swimsuit.
On happier beaches.
Well, the weird thing is, the implications was that doesn't look that bad. Is that because she must have found some calm water over there?
Yeah, unbelievable. What's that about, though?
What?
Celebrity.
Yeah, but it's so ridiculous. I mean, it's like, how dumb can you expect your public to be, or the people who are reading your paper to be?
Exactly.
I expect that of the Post to a certain extent, but the News.
Yeah, well, they both played. The News is actually the Post behind them on this one.
Jeff, isn't it like, unfortunately, this type of story is just a media goldmine in the sense is that, there's going to be a never-ending stream, and no pun intended, of human interest stories.
Yes. Oh,
of all different kinds.
Yeah. I spent Friday on MSNBC all day long, and the stories they're looking for now are the stories of survivors and the stories of heroes and all that, and the blogs are coming out with this.
Uh-huh.
Count on me to come back to blogs somehow or another. But they did an amazing job, actually, in this. The problem media had was the same problem the White House had, in a sense. They didn't get the gravity of this at first.
Mm.
They didn't see how huge and incredible this was. And when they finally did, they've actually been doing a decent job.
Right.
But the numbers are too big. They're too incomprehensible. And on weblogs, I'm finding amazing stories of individuals. This is really about individual human stories. Once again, it's humanitarian. It's human.
Yeah.
And the blogs have done an amazing, amazing job. There's one blog called My Bad Friend, Chien Sans Frontières. Dogs Without Borders.
That's pretty good.
It is pretty good. I know right. Yeah. And, he goes along and sees an orphanage that had been racked by war that had 150 children in it that now has 5.
Mm-hmm.
And the place is devastated. And you see that, a moment like that, there was another woman named Evelyn Rodriguez, who's a blogger who happened to be over there, and told amazing stories of just being sitting next to a Finnish kid who lost his parents, of watching one husband lose his wife, watching another husband find his wife.
Mm-hmm.
These are amazing goosebump moments out there. Other blogs come along. There's one called Tsunami Help, I believe, .blogspot.com, that has people, within 1 week, it's a tremendous resource of all these people coming together for everywhere you can contribute, and good news on you doing the PSA for Red Cross and other help that these places need. So the web really came together and did a great job here. We all saw the videos that way.
Except for the freaks that insisted on being paranoid and speculative.
Yeah, but you know, the New York Times did that this morning, and the problem was that was the headline, and that was the lead of saying, oh, look, yeah, there's a crackpot on the internet. Well, there's crackpots on every street corner.
Exactly.
And the truth was, on the weblogs, as the Times story said in due course, that sane people came in and told the crackpot to shut up.
True.
And that this really isn't about conspiracy theories, and no, it wasn't caused by oil drilling, and Mother Nature does this stuff.
But it was caused by the satellite, right? We'll be back in a second with Jeff Jarvis to finish our conversation about media, and the we're going to get into that the Freedom of Information Act request.
We'll update there, yes.
Terrific. It's 44 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley. Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses.
Yeah.
Philosopher kings.
Yeah.
Working class heroes.
Yeah.
Talk about the issues.
Yeah. Yeah.
Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron.
That's Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Morning Sedition.
We're fighting. We're fighting for our lives here.
How's everybody out there? Fire truck.
Am I stupid?
No. Right. Like they say uptown, talking more spit than a little bit.
Fire truck.
You're a heartless individual.
Hey, you guys, help me out.
Dog of the week.
Yahtzee.
Oh, yeah.
John Kerry took my shoe. Begin.
Oh, yeah.
Begin. Morning Sedition. Begin. Morning Sedition.
Yeah.
Let me introduce some people here. Kalo is on the board. Smarty Pants Larson in the booth. Brendan, P.W. McDonald. Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman of New Jersey in the other room. Morning Sedition. Coming in for landing. Good morning. On Wayne.
No. Can I leave now?
We have to edit that.
That one wasn't real, but you've gotten close to that.
Yeah, I know, exactly. And I understand management's not pleased, but
come on.
Ask me if I care.
We're back. It's Morning Edition. That's Wayne Gilman, who's co-hosting for Mark Riley, who we have validated is in England still.
Is he?
Yeah. Wayne, Jeff Jarvis
and
is here from BuzzMachine.com. We're talking about media coverage of the tsunami. We're talking a little bit about the bloggers, and even after the mild argument we had the last time about the importance of the blogosphere in terms of journalism, I agree with you that some of the stuff that was coming, the firsthand accounts, were very profound and
phenomenal.
And irreplaceable in terms
of
covering.
But what it really means is that anybody in the world can be a witness now. And you have the tools to be a witness, and that really showed off.
Yeah,
and so these videos are phenomenal. The Wall Street Journal does a big story today about video and blogs because of the tsunami and what we saw there. One poor guy named Pundit Guy put up some of the videos on his site, and he got within one day a bill for $1,000 in bandwidth.
Mm.
And he begged for help from others to come along. But, it's still pretty amazing to see how the swarm, the smart mob effect of this stuff can happen. And people brought out their eyewitness accounts, and that one tsunami help site is now number 4 on Google search for tsunami.
Mm.
That's the effect that this has. Everybody links to it, and it gives it authority.
And you can go to morningsedition.com to link up with some places where if you're looking for an avenue to help, you can help. Now, what about mainstream media? Jeff, who do you think's been doing the most efficient coverage?
CNN shines at moments like this.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. CNN has the moxie. Has the resources, has the experience, and knows how to do it. So CNN, which frankly has been getting duller than an old dog bone for the last year or so, really did come through, I think.
And there's no bias, when you watch them. I mean, as opposed to Fox and some of the other stations.
But Fox doesn't have the feet on the ground to be able to cover it the same way. They were covering Iraq a lot, but they didn't switch around, whereas CNN sent people. NBC did a good job, too. Kevin Seitz, who's a blogger and correspondent who was in Iraq, boom, he went right over there and has been doing excellent reports.
I guess Anderson Cooper, now that his shoes aren't going to get too dirty, has gone over there. Like, what, 7 days later here?
Yeah. Well, I don't mean to be mean to her because she's a very nice lady, but Ann Curry can drive me absolutely bonkers on the Today Show with her pathos of emotion when bad things happen, right?
Yeah.
Well, she was on Dateline last night, and she was actually superb because she didn't have to amplify the pain.
Also, the images are speaking for themselves. They're actually letting a lot of very graphic, you know, horrifying, horrible images of corpses on the air and in print as well.
Exactly.
Which, like, I've never seen before, actually.
Well, yeah, we don't do it in war as much, but here it's a different thing. So I think the coverage has gotten better and better and better. At first, they absolutely missed it. I missed it, too. We didn't know the full gravity of this. Then it hit, you know, right square in the head, and I think media's done a very good job. And so now you have Brian Williams is going to be over there tonight.
Wow.
The anchors are headed over there. I saw on CNN this morning the lovely, what's her name? Soledad O'Brien was over there. You know, it's they've recognized now the importance of this, and they're over there to get the stories. And you're absolutely right, Mark, what you said. There's a never-ending stream of human interest stories to be had here.
Right.
That's going to be a problem in the long run. We're going to exploit this, and we're going to play it too much. But right now, I think the coverage is good.
Well, like we were just saying before, there are stories that aren't being covered. I mean, this is a story that came through our show. We haven't covered this. A teenager who escaped death but was left orphaned and homeless by the Asian tsunami met yet one more agony, gang rape. Mm-hmm. One of several cases of child abuse being investigated in a disaster zone. Apparently, in these refugee situations where there are a lot of children and teenagers whose parents are no longer with them or they're separated or dead, that they're being, you know, there are sexual predators in mobs. It's amazing the type of chaos of the spirit that comes out in these catastrophes.
Yeah, and the script for this, the media script for this is we want to find the heartwarming story.
Right.
And we want to ignore the bad story. That's a bad story. I got a letter from a blogger saying there was a lot about what happened to prostitutes in Phuket. And you know, should I write that story? I told him, yes, you should. We've seen stories about people trying to rip off folks who are trying to get money. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the bad side comes out, too.
Exactly. And we're living in a decadent age now. I mean, and not to say that, you know, this kind of tragedy will eliminate that kind of behavior. It goes on regardless of where you are. People are trying to capitalize on a tragic situation.
Exactly.
So, yeah, we still, you know, the jury, we'll see if our government does that.
Right.
in all honesty, but you know, I don't know what it will take. You know, it'll take history to tell that story. But you know, in terms of war and in national catastrophe, I mean, you know, free market capitalism has always, you know, found a place to wedge itself in there and make a few bucks.
It will.
So let's talk about this Freedom of Information Act.
Just a quick update with your kind producer. We decided to do a joint Freedom of Information request to the FCC, and the FCC cut us off at the pass. Mm-hmm. We asked to see the 9 complaints that had caused an investigation of indecency at the Olympics.
Uh-huh.
And the FCC just posted them on the internet. And it's laughable. I think a lot of them probably came from Howard Stern fans who are trying to game the FCC
because
they go on about Oprah and so on. But a couple complained about the F word. One complained about showing a beach volleyball star as too sexy. How can you do that?
That's right. One obsessive freak out there who's like, oh, no, I can't. I'm sweating.
Instead of celebrating the greatness of mankind, as represented by the Olympic spirit, they showed pictures designed to incite lust and immorality, roots of many of the social ills facing our nation today. And I said that's either a brilliant Stern prankster or somebody who badly needs a dose of Viagra.
It's so relative. They're like, yeah, that could have just been someone sitting on a bench person.
So 9 people. So somebody, some bureaucrat is paid right now to sit there and watch the Olympics and try to find the F word and whether something is a little nasty. Nasty and that horrible opening ceremony, which would put any normal person to sleep.
Oh, man. This just,
it's sex. That's how we all got here on Earth. It's okay.
Yeah,
and the FCC is trying to eliminate it.
Oh, no, I'm uncomfortable in my pants. I need to write a letter. Jeff Jarvis, thank you for joining us. Always good to talk to you.
Thank you. See you soon. Yep.
And Wayne Gilman, of course, it was great.
It's been a pleasure, also.
Great having you.
Really?
I'm going to still see you every day, though, right?
I appreciate it.
You didn't do anything that bad.
Right.
Come on.
Okay.
Here's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for today. 1, resolutions for 2005. To avoid Bush burnout, divide frustration, anger, and resentment equally among Bush cabinet members over the next 4 years. 2, protest the destruction of the Amazon rainforest by having Cristo wrap it in orange pleather. Pleather. Funny word, but no laughs here. 3, work with designers to finally make hemp clothing fashionable enough for people who aren't stoned to actually wear in public. 4, don't just diet. hunger strike. Five, today's phrase, slip this into conversation. Oh, sure, the quake and the tsunami were an accident. I guess the secret Pentagon weather control project had nothing to do with it, huh? Just stay asleep, sheeple. You're not ready for the truth, man. No. Tomorrow, Anthony LaPay from GNN is going to be my guest host. Riley will be back Wednesday. We also have former Navy lawyer John Hudson to discuss why he opposes the confirmation of Alberto Gonzalez. So be back. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Wayne. See you tomorrow, folks.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.